This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. We continue our series called A Summer Celebration of Women. Last week we chatted with the winner of the 2019 Pulitzer Prize, Ellen Reed. This week we'll chat with her good friend, who together with Ellen runs the Luna Composition Lab based at the Kauffman Center in Midtown Manhattan, giving support and opportunity to teenage young female-identifying composers. She herself is one of this country's most sought-after composers, Missy Mazzoli. She hails from Lansdale, PA, and her wide interests growing up included music, starting as a pianist, but the draw to create was strong. She studied at Boston University and Yale and at the Royal Conservatory of The Hague. She currently teaches at the Manus College of Music. The critical acclaim for her music began early on and is borne out in her past composer residencies with the Albany Symphony Orchestra and Opera Philadelphia, and continues now as she is in her second year with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. She is one of two women, the first to be commissioned by the Metropolitan Opera, and opera is where she's making a strong mark. Her operas Songs from the Uproar, Breaking the Waves, and Proving Up have all garnered outstanding reviews and much praise, gaining her monikers such as Brooklyn's Postmillennial Mozart. Her instrumental orchestral works have also been widely commissioned and performed, whether by ensembles such as her own Victoire, formed in 2007 to perform her music, all the way up to ensembles such as the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. You're listening to the opening minutes of A Song for Mick Kelly from the album Cathedral City, as performed by Victoire, released in 2010 and named one of that year's best classical albums by the New York Times. I spoke with Missy Mazzoli by phone last week. So I'm very glad to be speaking with composer Missy Mazzoli. I wanted to speak with you for a long time, but I'm glad I could do it now because you're part of this three-month series on Cadenza, which I'm simply calling Summer Celebration of Women. And though in the coming weeks I will have a conductor and we'll have some instrumentalists and some ensembles, so far it's been all composers. It's been Lisa Bielava, Maria Schneider, Ellen Taves-Willick, and last week your good friend Ellen Reed. So all of those guests have stated it, but you've been very forward in the need to see tangible growth in the field of gender equality. And there's lots of statistics. If you just want to take one and take, you know, it's the classical music world, so the symphony orchestra, for say, less than 2% of the total works programmed by 22 of the largest American orchestras are women. About only 14% of composers writing at the level of a professional orchestra are women. But you've made an impact, and you've had a pretty heady 10 years plus here. And so right off the bat, I did this with Ellen at the end of the cadenza, but right off the bat, I want to talk about how you and her, if you want to go into the Luna Lab, are mentoring, helping, guiding, giving exposure and connections to young female-defining composers. Talk about what you're doing.
Sure, yeah. I mean, well, you know, those statistics you mentioned, really, I don't feel that they've changed significantly in my lifetime.
I could have said them 15 years ago, 20 years ago, it was the same. So, you know.
Exactly. And so, and you know, when I got out of school, I thought, oh, in 20 years, things will be different, and they're not.
Right.
And so that really inspired me to look deep into why this was happening in a very calm, sort of unemotional way. And I came to two conclusions, you know, which is that it's a lack of female role models. You know, so young women who want to enter the field don't see a path forward because they don't see women programmed on concerts and teaching at universities, et cetera. But also, you know, that there was something happening to young women in their teens and early 20s that was discouraging them from entering the field.
Okay.
And I think in addition to the lack of role models, it was everything from like good old-fashioned sexism to not having a community of peers, you know, to being subtly and overtly discouraged in a bunch of ways during those crucial years when you're deciding what to do with your life and deciding to be a professional musician. So to that end, you know, Ellen and I started Luna Composition Lab in collaboration with the Kaufman Music Center and their program, Face the Music, to sort of try to solve this problem from all sides. You know, so we're targeting young women and girls in their teens. And I should say female identifying, non-binary, and gender non-conforming is our official description.
Right.
And we're pairing them with prominent female mentors in the field. So it's a very simple idea, but they leave the program, you know, armed with an incredible recording of their work. And more importantly, someone they can talk to, someone they can ask questions of when it comes to time to like apply to college or, you know, what should I do this summer? What program should I apply to this summer? How do I get my orchestra piece out there? Like all these things are so such a mystery. Now they have someone to ask, someone who looks like them.
We should say this is ages 13 to 19. So this
yeah.
kind of pre-college, just entering college years, middle school years. I gather also what you just said is, I mean, if they go through the Luna Composition Lab, you're connecting them up. I mean, you've got partners that range from the New York Philharmonic on down. But I guess then also when they get past those years, I mean, as you found out, that when you're out of school, it's a little bit different world. Male composers, I was reading up for this, it's, you know, somebody says, well, they have potential. And women composers say, well, can she really write? You know, I mean, it's like this proving thing. And that's changing, but it's slow. I don't know if there's a question there. It's just a statement. But
no, I think that this proof versus potential thing is the thing that I always point to, especially when it comes to really large scale, ambitious work like opera or a large scale symphony work. Every commission that is made in opera or for an orchestra or for, you know, something like an hour-long string quartet or an installation, all these big commissions are based on a composer's potential. That's what you're commissioning. And I think that men are, that's seen, like their potential is seen. And he hasn't written an opera yet, but he has it in him to write an opera.
Right.
And I never see that with young women.
Right.
I never see these institutions taking a chance on extremely young women. I should say, you know, I'm starting to a little bit, but the degree to which I don't see them taking a chance on, you know, a young 23-year-old who has a brilliant capacity to write for voice and to do something dramatic is shocking, and that disparity is shocking. So I do think that this proof versus potential thing is a big problem. And when it comes to something like opera, what are you going to do? Like produce four operas by yourself and then present them to a committee and say, look, now I know how to write opera. That's totally unrealistic.
Right. And with a woman composer, it's kind of, oh, she wrote an opera. You know, you see where the opposite type of inflection of, you know, he has the potential to write an opera. Yeah, I get it. And of course, you know, with Ellen, you know, just this huge explosion on the scene winning the Pulitzer with an opera, you know, and the subject mm-hmm. matter and everything aside, it's just, things are changing, but you're right. Things have to accelerate. Here are the opening minutes from my guest Missy Mazzoli's work titled Magic with Everyday Objects, performed by the Now Ensemble. For you, composition, we should say that you grew up, you're right at the fringe of our listening area, but anybody who's gone up the Pennsylvania Turnpike Extension knows where you come from, because you're from Lansdale.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And composition was kind of an epiphany moment for you. You're around 10 years old and it was like, oh, I can study this type of thing. So you kind of knew that this is what, or actually take us back there and then how you kind of knew, yeah, that's what I want to do. This is what I should be doing. This is how I'm going to persevere, or maybe things you would have done differently. Just take us back to those moments of figuring, yeah, I should create, you know.
You know, it's really hard for me to remember a time when I wasn't creating. Right. I mean, I started taking piano lessons when I was 7, but then I very quickly realized that I was not destined to be a famous pianist. I love playing piano. I still play piano. I'm playing a show tonight in New York, but there's always going to be someone who plays Beethoven better than I can.
Right.
So, and in addition, I had all these other interests. You know, even as a kid, I was interested in poetry and theater and being in plays and making movies with my sister, you know, and like always creating something, always creating shows. So composition, I sensed from it early on that that was something that would allow me to do everything. And certainly this shift into opera, which is not exclusively what I do now, but it is a big part of my life now.
Sure.
Is
yeah.
A sort of natural outgrowth of those impulses.
You first started just writing pieces you played yourself at the piano, or were you already just pushed beyond that and started writing things that others would perform and interpret? I'm just curious.
I think I started writing for myself, and then, you know, I think like every like ambitious high school kid, I wrote an orchestra piece before I even really knew what I was doing and had it performed by the North Penn Symphony.
Yeah.
in Lansdale. Not even performed. No, they just read through it.
Right.
Which was like the greatest moment of my life up to that point. I mean, it was just, I was like, oh yeah, this is amazing. But you know, the other thing was just like going and being around musicians and like sitting in on rehearsals, you know, going to like Philadelphia Orchestra rehearsals and Philly Pop rehearsals. My professor, composition teacher, was in the Philly Pop. He played percussion, Lou Delee. So I was like, oh, these are my people. But I want to be around these people,
right? Right,
who are working and interested in art and sharing, talking about ideas.
As you mentioned, your pianist based in the keyboard. I mean, a strong element of your music, which you can hear, is a harmonic bass, a chordal kind of bass. That's always there. It's a very strong foundation.
Mm-hmm.
But instrumental music seems natural. You know, the symphony reads through your piece. How does vocal music come into your composing and then take it to the next step, a dramatic context for vocal music? How does that happen?
Well, you know, I think even in my purely instrumental works, I'm always thinking about drama. Mm. I'm always thinking about a very human drama. And, you know, in the orchestral pieces or the string quartets, you know, it's the melodies or the chords that take on these sort of human characteristics of, you know, pushing and pulling against each other or working in tandem with each other, supporting each other, and then in opposition to each other and going on some sort of journey over the, whatever, the 10 minutes of the piece. And that's how still how I conceive of all my music. So the move to opera was really natural. I had an epiphany. I was working on this short scene with the director, Daniel Fish, at Opera Philadelphia when I was in residence there. He was asking me about the psychology of the characters, and I turned to him and I was like, this is my destiny. Like, I've been waiting 20 years for someone to ask me these questions. Like, this is what I want to be talking about. And this is how I thought of music the whole time. And certainly, like, I love working with singers. I think that like there's some of the hardest working committed musicians that I've worked with recently, and just the physical stamina, and I mean they're like gifted athletes who have voices that are as rare as the skills of like a really astonishing Olympic athlete. So
yeah.
It's been thrilling.
We're going to get to the operas in a moment, but I mean just to stay on the vocal thing, because once a composer
yeah.
crosses into that line, and there have been composers, I mean I think of, well, she's now close to being the dean of American composers, Joan Tower. She just avoided it for decades, because once
mm-hmm.
you have text, you have to choose text, and then you have to, I mean that's a crossover for someone who was very instrumentally based growing up, was it not? The choosing text, finding text, and then setting it?
You know, I mean, like, I don't think of it that way.
Okay.
I mean, the way it happened in my life is that I encountered all these amazing collaborators, like number one being Roy Stavrick, my librettist.
Yeah.
And we're working on our fourth and fifth operas right now. So we have this like a decade of collaboration behind us. We talk every day. And he's very amenable to me changing things, adjusting things, having these deep conversations about the text. So it's not just that I'm finding something and then I'm beholden to it. You know, it's a living, breathing, very much an alive part of the composition. And certainly like working with drama and and directors, you know, informs that too. So I don't see it as crossing over. I mean, like, I'm writing my fourth opera right now, but then I'm going to happily take a break from opera for like a year and then write a couple other big instrumental works and then go back to opera for this piece that I'm writing for the Met.
Right.
I don't see myself as sort of Jake Heggie, who's, you know, really has focused almost exclusively on opera in a very effective way. I'm still doing everything. I'm still performing, still doing electronic music.
Yeah.
All that.
Opera can be very all-consuming, and you need to, like, build in time. So from the latest release featuring my guests, music performed by her ensemble, or band, Victoire, here featuring special guest percussionists from the band Wilco, Glenn Cochi, the CD is titled Vespers for a New Dark Age. The closing minutes of the track, Come On All You, music of Mitzi Mazzoli. So if we pick up the career, I mean, awards start coming, recognition, performances, commissions, some of them from pretty big name artists. I mean, to name a few, I mean, Kronos, Emmanuel Ax performed your stuff. Shai Wassner's recorded your stuff. Residency in Albany. You mentioned the residency at Opera Company Philadelphia. You're now going to second year of my hometown band because I was born in Chicago, the Chicago Symphony Orchestra.
Yay!
We'll get back to that. But as all this stuff started to roll, I mean, I said it's been a pretty heady 10 plus years here. Did it seem pretty organic as far as the pace of your composing, or were there like maturation points where you like someone asked you for pieces like, oh boy, you know, or was it a pretty steady flow over these years if you look back over the decade?
Yeah, you know, it's been... you know, I haven't even had time to think about it.
That's good.
It's weird to look back and pretend that I had any sort of, that I felt in control of my destiny at any point. You know, it really was just day to day. Things would come up. And I think I have a pretty good internal compass as to what is going to serve me and what I can do, the situations in which I can do my best work and the collaborators with which I can do my best work. So I've just listened to that really intensely and happened to be in New York at a sort of like an amazing time where not only operatically, I mean, I think we're in a new golden age of opera, especially in New York, but just like the instrumentalists who are around me. I mean, like tonight I'm going to, you know, do a show with Nadia Sirota that she's hosting for this new podcast she's doing. And it's just like, these are just my friends. These are just the people you encounter on the street. So I feel that, you know, I just go with what gives me energy and what makes me feel alive and the people who do that.
Okay. So, I mean, as things kept coming your way, it wasn't like, oh, wow, that's, you just said, yeah, this will work. I mean, you kind of looked at who was going to be performing your works or who was asking for your works or who wanted to work with you. And it all just seemed to make sense, right? I mean, that's what I'm kind of hearing.
Yeah.
That's very cool.
Yeah. It's been incredible.
It's incredible.
Everything leads to something else too. You know, it's like every project you do opens the door to like 10 other possibilities. So I just kind of let that happen.
That's not the story of every composer. So it's been pretty cool.
Yeah.
And we should say, well, now 12 years ago, I guess, if my math is right, you kind of ensured there'd be performances of your work when you formed this Ensemble Victoire, which performs your works. Talk us about the instrumentation of this group, the musicians who play in this, and kind of the mission that it had when you founded it and still has. And I mean, talk about this ensemble.
Sure, yes. I founded this ensemble. Even that sounds much more official than it actually was. I mean, I in 2007, right after I moved to New York, you know, I just wasn't inundated with performances and offers and gigs. And so I thought, well, I'm going to start a band, essentially. Yeah. I had friends who were touring around the world in indie rock bands, and like I wanted to take the best of that world, the sort of touring pop music album producing world, and the best of classical music, which is like this virtuosity and this precision and this care and this open sonic palette, and I wanted to combine them into one project. So I started Victoire. The instrumentation is violin, clarinet, two keyboards, one of which I play, and then double bass, and then sometimes a vocalist. And the players, I mean, I should mention them, in violin, Olivia DiPrato, clarinet, Eileen Mack, keyboard, Lorna Creer, and double bass, Eleanor Oppenheim. I mean, these are some of my best friends, and our rehearsal sessions became a sort of like test kitchen to try things out for me as a composer. And we played our first gig in my living room, and then I think like 6 years later, we played Carnegie Hall. So in between that, you can imagine like the range of shows that we played is just tremendous. And like these crazy tours across the Midwest playing, you know, to either hundreds of people or to three people. You know, and it was like sometimes like night after night, it would switch like that much. I mean, it was just a really crazy time. But it felt amazing to take control of my output in that way. And to, instead of sitting around in my apartment waiting for, you know, H. Blackbird to call me up and offer me a commission, you know, or for the New York Phil to like notice me, I was just making stuff. There was nothing holding me back.
It's kind of one of the upsides to what has been a really great trend over the last generation, kind of, which is the return of the composer, performer, performer, composer. I mean, you played keyboard, so there's no problem in forming your own band or group, as you say, because, you know, you would perform in it. It's kind of an upside to this that's happened. So my guest, Missy Mazzoli's opera, Breaking the Waves, was commissioned and premiered by Opera Philadelphia to great acclaim with librettist Royce Vavrick. It adapts the Lars von Trier 1996 Cannes Grand Prix winning film. Here's an excerpt sung by the main character, Bess, the voice of Kira Duffy. The opera garnered the 2017 Best New Opera Award from the Music Critics of North America.
Beautiful music.
So if we go to opera, you've made your mark. So much of the critical acclaim has been so positive with these strange monikers you get, like Brooklyn's post-millennial Mozart, but the reviews are filled with words like most and best of the 21st, modern, original, I mean, all this kind of stuff. So before we go to your operas, I mean, where were you at with opera as its traditional form in the repertoire of opera? What did you know? Where was opera in your world as you were forming as a composer?
I mean, it really wasn't anywhere for a very long time. Like, there was just, I felt so many barriers between me and opera. Number one, like, being the ticket price when I was growing up and just not knowing where to begin. And also feeling like people who liked opera were obsessed with opera. And I kind of had this feeling, oh, it's all or nothing. And there wasn't the sort of explosion of contemporary work. Even 15 years ago, there was not, the operatic landscape looked very different. But I was very interested in theater, and I was very interested in music videos as a kid.
Okay.
And I think that the combination of the two is what pushed me into opera, more so than wanting to be a part of the classical operatic tradition. I wanted to be into the theater, and I felt it to be a more vital, immediate art form, that it could respond to what's going on in the world in a faster, more effective way than opera. And since then, I should say, I love opera, and I've come around and I'm finding things in the tradition that are extraordinary. Even in the most traditional overplayed pieces, you know, they're just extraordinary. I love La Boheme. I find new things in it every time I see it and hear it. But, you know, in terms of being, you know, a 21-year-old or 17-year-old person who's just starting out, like, the opera was nowhere on my radar.
Well, it's interesting because you're not the first composer who's doing opera now who's kind of said that, which means in one way, you don't come with all the operatic awe-inspired baggage that comes with that. Like, you know, I'm never going to write to Meistersinger or something like, you know, I mean, you don't come with that. You kind of approach it. And you know, there are composers, including yourself, who are now changing the framework, the tradition, even the definition of opera. I've had Christopher Cerrone on, and, you know, with his virtual opera that took place in Union Station in L.A., and Lisa Bielava just released this opera that is serialized, which you can watch it, you know, binge watch it or watch it in an episode. And your operas, we should mention, you know, Song from the Uproar, Breaking the Waves, Proving Up. One thing about them, and it goes back, I guess, to how we opened our conversation, is all of them have either totally or have very strong central female characters. I guess the question is, and if you could slip in, I mean, you are the first woman to be commissioned by the Met, you know,
along with Janine Tesori.
And if we love statistics, I mean, the Met did finally do an opera by a woman, Cara Sarriaho. And that was a couple years ago, and that was the first opera they'd done by a woman for 113 years. My math was bad there. So it was a 113-year run of guys at the opera stage. But again, sort of your approach to opera, what you are looking to do in the subject matter you choose, and then if you could kind of finish that off with whatever you can say about the Met Commission.
Sure. Yeah, you know, of course, I'm drawn to stories of women in impossible situations.
Sure.
You know, you could say that that's opera as a whole, but I'm really interested in women who find themselves in an extraordinary place and have to do something extraordinary, either to get themselves out of that or to go deeper into that. So, yeah, and look, I mean, I'm a woman, like, and this is my experience in the world. And so it makes sense that I'd be drawn to that. And also, I want to create female characters that are a little, on the whole, a little more complicated than most female characters in the operatic tradition.
Right.
And I think we're in a place where, as a society, we have the language to do that, and then we're more open to that. So that's, you know, one of my goals. For in terms of the Met piece, it's an adaptation of the George Saunders book, Lincoln and the Bardo, which maybe probably be my first opera that does not necessarily have a woman at its center. But, you know, George's work, he's my favorite writer. So to work with him is a dream. Royce will be writing the libretto, but, you know, I've been talking to George about that book and that text a little bit, which has just been amazing. His work is very surreal. It's very timely, and it deals with big ideas about, you know, life and death and what we leave behind and our inability to accept death as, you know, especially as Westerners, and history and the figure of Abraham Lincoln is this sort of icon and what does that mean? And there's all these really juicy things to dig into.
And I think we go back to what we were talking about, what you're doing with Luna Composition Lab, sort of mentoring and giving these young female composers something to see. I mean, yeah, not all. There have been some very strong female operatic characters in some of the great operas, but, you know, a lot of times the female is either going mad or has mm-hmm. given her life to save the guy who's a schmuck, you know, type of thing, mm-hmm. Redemption through the female, the very romantic notion. But I guess your operas, whether conscious or not, you know, in some way, you're putting a character up there, which a young composer who happens to be female would look and see the opera and say, oh, okay, I get it, you know. These characters mm-hmm. can carry the piece. They can be the piece. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a very strong statement. As far as, I mean, you're going to have to deal with the Met, whether it's going to be produced on stage, whether it has, you know, any kind of special effects or whatever. That's happening with opera, with technology. Just as far as the traditional framework of how opera is produced, how it's seen, who sees it, I mean, mm-hmm. I would think that would interest you as well, to kind of change that metric as well.
Sure. Yeah.
So, you can't do that with the Met. They're going to have to pay the ticket price and go in and sit inside and all the rest of that. With Opera mm-hmm. Company of Philadelphia, it was a stage work. I'm just saying, are your thoughts moving towards creating works in the operatic field, since this really has caught your imagination and your muse, that really sort of push the boundaries in that direction as far as who hears it and how they can hear it?
Yeah. You know, I mean, I think that, like, the simplest thing that I can do to that end is just to constantly show up in the public eye,
right,
and just to show potential opera audiences that I am a person, I am alive, I'm, like, relatively youngish, and, you know, living in Brooklyn, like, just in 2019, dealing with all the same stuff politically and in society that they're dealing with. So as much as I can talk about that and use these outlets to amplify that voice, then I feel like that, hopefully, that is reaching a new audience. I can't single-handedly change these massive institutions. And it's not a shock that, you know, people are raging against high ticket prices and the sort of perceived elitism of opera, which feels to me to be completely the opposite of what opera is at its core and what opera can be in terms of an art form. Opera, you know, has something for everybody. And I mean, imagining myself as a little kid who loved MTV and loved music videos, like, I love Guns N' Roses videos for the same reason that I love opera. It is just like this massive, all-encompassing, like, dramatic, over-the-top kind of thing. And so there's a million ways into it. And this sort of, like, the elitism of it, I think, gets in the way, of course. I don't have, like, a stock answer of how to solve that, except to just, for me, be myself and continue to show up and continue to talk about it, continue to bring young people into this world in a really fun and easy way.
Yeah, you, along with other composers, are going to change this, but I've always scratched my head just about what you said, and especially in a generation that kind of grew up with MTV and music videos, where a piece of music had a visual with it that was, and sometimes, dramatic. That why mm-hmm. opera hasn't caught on in a mass media type of cable TV download, binge watching, you know, platform type of, I can't figure it out. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah.
It should. Everything's ripe for it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I know. Look, I agree. And I think that, like, we're seeing that. We're edging in that direction. I really do feel that. But yeah, we'll see.
Turning to a track from my guest's earlier opera, Song from the Uproar, The Lives and Deaths of Isabel Eberhardt, inspired by the journals of this explorer, nomad, journalist, novelist, passionate romantic, Sufi, and one of the most unique and unusual women of her era. At age 20, after the death of her mother, brother, and father, she left her life in Switzerland for a nomadic and unfettered existence in the deserts of North Africa. She traveled extensively through the desert on horseback, often dressed as a man, relentlessly documenting her travels through detailed journals. At age 27, she drowned in a flash flood in the desert. Here's the track, I Am Not Mine, again with the Now Ensemble and the voice of Abigail Fisher, music by Missy Mazzoli.
Not mine anymore. He is my only cause.
I don't want to slight your other output. Your instrumental works, orchestral chamber works, receive many performances. I know in our Monday night program, which is going into its 10th year, which is celebrating a musical future, where we present concerts from the great music schools. One of the first schools that has partnered with us for all those years has been Rutgers, Mason Gross School of the Arts. And I know Kynan there has done two of your orchestral works. So our listeners have heard them played by the Rutgers Symphony Orchestra over the years, along with other places. These works are, for the most part, they're title-driven. I mean, the titles have something to do with what's being expressed in the music. There aren't abstract titles of Symphony No. 1, String Quartet No. 3, you know, Construction Piece No. 4. Just talk about your non-vocal abstract music, as it were, and how you go about creating it and what it expresses, how that works into the titling, and just that. The opera is driven by an outside text, but talk about your other music that way.
Sure. Well, it's really impossible to talk about everything under sort of one umbrella. Every piece is its own complete little universe. You kind of think of this piece, River Rouge Transfiguration, that I wrote for the Detroit Symphony, you know, was influenced very much by the landscape of Detroit and that city and that history. And the photographs of Charles Sheeler that he made of the River Rouge plant, which he makes the whole plant look like a giant pipe organ. So that, to me, was my in there. Okay, Detroit as pipe organ, which then, you know, opens it up to, like, quoting Bach and chorales and sort of referencing turning orchestra into a pipe organ. So that is one example.
Yeah, I don't mean to umbrella all your pieces under one, but I'm just saying as you go in to compose a piece like this, you've already got a kind of visual, almost title-driven piece in your head that you're then working to create. You're not creating music and then saying, oh, I'll call it this. It sounds like this. I mean, you're dealing with that narrative up front that you want to get across. Okay. That's what
exactly. Yeah. Again, everything is very sort of human-driven narrative.
Yeah.
I like good stories. I like good stories about people. So, yeah, even the instrumental work it comes out of that.
Yeah. There's interesting strains as you go through the various recordings of your music, whether it's with Victoire, whether it's, you know, whether other people are interpreting your music. It's, you know, there's that Vespers strain that goes through. I just like, there's different things that you could pick up which kind of move you along with people who've kind of been following your music over the years and see how it comes out. How does that translate into, like, the residency you're doing with the Chicago Symphony? I mean, is that something where you are working on a piece that they will play, or a number of pieces, and you go in with, they're going to do some of my past pieces, or go in with the notion that I will be creating new material? How does that work as far as a residency with an orchestra that with that much recognition?
Yes, I've just finished an orchestral work for Chicago,
right,
called Orpheus Undone.
Okay.
And that will premiere in April of 2020, conducted by Maestro Muti. Yeah, so that's been my big sort of creative project. And, you know, most of my work in Chicago has been in curating their chamber music series, Music Now, which is their contemporary chamber music series at the Harris Theater in Millennium Park. And so I feel like that has really been the focus, you know? I mean, of course, writing for the Chicago Symphony is a dream, but it's really what makes the residency different from a commission is just the ability to immerse myself in Chicago's incredible music community, which is not one community. It's like a million different communities of people doing incredible things. And to be able to showcase that a little bit is incredible.
I got to work with Maestro Muti a bit here when he was leading Philadelphia. And I know he's gotten older and he's, but, you know, he's one of these kind of maestros who, you know, have this aura about them, as it were, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering how working with someone like that, I mean, you've worked with other symphony orchestras, you've worked with other conductors, but someone like that as approaching a new work of yours, a new work, I don't know, everything we've talked about here, being a female composer, I mean, how has that experience been so far in working? I know you'll work more with him with the new piece, but I mean, how has that been working with him so far?
Well, you know, we haven't honestly worked so much together on the music because I just finished.
Okay. All right. So that'll be coming.
So, so it'll be like this fall that we'll start talking about it. And then obviously as the date approaches, we'll work together more intensely. So I don't know. I mean, but I do know that, you know, the staff at the CSO on the whole has just been really welcoming and very open to a lot of like my crazy ideas, particularly when it comes to programming the chamber music. So it's on the whole, it's a really nice environment.
Good. good. And I mean, you had the residency in Albany. You enjoy these. I mean, when this ends, I mean, would you, I don't know whether opera will get in the way or compositions, commissions get in the way, but will you then maybe look to do this again in some kind of fashion with either a orchestra or a festival or something like that?
Oh, sure. Yeah. No, and you know, something, I'm doing some curating, you know, with San Francisco Symphony, with LA Chamber Orchestra.
Okay.
And those are more like one-off things. And, you know, Ellen is composer in residence at LA Chamber Orchestra, but I'm just curating one show. So things like that are really amazing. You know, before the Chicago gig, I'd never been asked to curate anything.
Okay.
But I had all these ideas for years. So when they asked me, I was like, all right, these are the 6 concerts I want to do this year. And I just had so many ideas. And I meet composers all the time. Like, I'm just constantly inundated with new work by composers from all over the world. So I feel like I have access to like a really broad swath of the scene. But yeah, it's great. And I really hope that it continues.
So my guest Missy Mazzoli's music keeps turning up, and that will be a regular occurrence. We've broadcast 2 concerts on our Monday night Celebrating Our Musical Future series with Maestro Kynan Johns programming her music to be played by his Rutgers Symphony Orchestra. Here are the final minutes from her River Rouge Transfiguration, as recorded by the Rutgers Symphony Orchestra back in March of 2018. Well, you know, I'm a fan of your music, but I'm also really a fan of what you're doing. You know, and so, you know, there might come a time And I know we always have the problem of greatness in the mix, which is legitimate, where, you know, someone says, name a composer, and, you know, maybe that young girl, or you might not say Mozart or Beethoven first. They might say Missy Mazzoli or somebody, or some, I'm just saying, you know, there's that instantaneous, you know, name somebody great, and it defaults to the long lineage of male people who have sort of dominated that craft and that skill. But, you know, things are changing. So I really applaud what you're doing, and I keep up all the good work.
Thank you.
Yeah, I close all my cadenza interviews by asking my guests the same two questions. And the first question is a hypothetical, which says, if you could chat, like we've been chatting, but with someone from the past who you never had a chance to talk to but could. Sometimes you can get flooded with names. I'm just curious, when I asked that, the first name that popped into your head of somebody you would have loved to talk with in the past.
I mean, it probably wouldn't have been a very fun conversation, but I mean, Beethoven is my idol.
Oh, okay.
I could not miss an opportunity to just, like, I'd like to go on a walk with him. and then I'd like to get a drink with him, and then that's it. Yeah.
Yeah.
I did that walk, like, outside of Vienna where he wrote the Heiligenstadt Testament and, like, followed his path through what used to be a meadow and was trying to commune with the spirit of Beethoven last summer. So, yeah, I would do that.
You would take the notebook and just any mutterings that came out, because obviously you'd have to, like, poke him on the shoulder if you wanted to actually say something to him, you know, get his attention.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. God bless him.
There's something operatic in there, actually, I think. Anyway, final question is non-musical. Everybody I interview on Cadenza fills their life with music. You're extremely busy with all you got going on, operatically in the CSO and everything else. When you have to do something that's non-musical, pull yourself away from it, pleasure, relaxation, enjoyment, what do? If you need a little respite.
I go to the beach. Yeah, I love the beach. Love it. Beach, ocean, very dramatic. Love it.
So growing up in Lansdale, you went down the shore, but I mean...
Oh, down the shore, the Ocean City, yep.
And then, so this is just any beach will do, just that you just need to hear the ocean and feel the sand type of thing?
Yeah. I mean, I love these gritty beaches, like, you know, having grown up by the Jersey Shore, like this sort of gritty boardwalk style thing. And here in New York, and going to the Rockaways, I love that sort of gritty New York Queens style beach too.
Well, Missy Mazzoli, thanks for taking some time.
Thank you for speaking to me. It's been great.
Composer Missy Mazzoli. You can find out more about her at her website, Missy, M-I-S-S-Y, Mazzoli, M-A-Z-Z-O-L-I.com. Her works appear on a number of different labels. Her recordings with her Victoire Ensemble are on New Amsterdam Records at newamrecords.com. And that most recent recital of works by young female-identifying composers that attended Missy and last week Cadenza guest Ellen Reed's Luna Composition Lab at the Kauffman Music Center in New York City will be coming your way in September as the opening program in the 10th season of Celebrating Our Musical Future. I'll leave you with the closing minutes from the, not Beethoven, but Brahms-inspired work by my guest, a work that pianists such as Emmanuel Axe have performed in concert. Here it's played by Nadia Spachenko. It is titled Bolts of Loving Thunder, music by my guest today, Missy Mazzoli. And as always, I'm glad you're in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to wwfm.org and clicking on Classical and then Webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been the award-winning Cadenza, an exclusive production of the Classical Network and WWFM.org.